The Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. It's a program about state and local politics. And as we listen back to the program, you can email your comments into the studio, and I'll read those comments when you email them in. I'll read them on the air after we hear this replay of Florida This Week for the next 26 minutes or so. Our address, our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's listen to Florida This Week. We're going to talk about the incoming governor, some of the big things that the governor did in his first week in office. We're also going to talk about the felons voting amendment, the amendment that allows ex-felons to register to vote for Florida in Florida automatically. So we'll talk about that too and see how it's going to change the face of Florida politics. Here's Florida This Week from this past Friday night. Coming up next, Ron DeSantis is sworn in as Florida's new governor, but outgoing governor Rick Scott hangs on till the last minute and appoints dozens of people in his last few days in office. Florida gets its first Hispanic woman on the state Supreme Court as the court membership moves to the right. In their first televised debate, the candidates for Tampa mayor differ on police policies. And voting registration jumps as Amendment 4 goes into effect. Political Insights next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. This week, our panelists are Noah Pransky is an investigative reporter. Vic DiMaio is a political consultant and a Democrat. Molly Moorhead is an editorial writer for the Tampa Bay Times. And Akash Patel is the founder and president of Elevate Incorporated and a Republican. Well, nice to see you, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Well, newly elected Governor Ron DeSantis was sworn in on Tuesday, vowing to continue what Republicans have been doing for years, promising less government.
That our rights are endowed by God, not by government. That we, the people, loan power to government under the Constitution in order to protect our rights. That government's role is not to run our lives for us, but to provide what Lincoln called an open field and fair chance for one's industry, enterprise, and intelligence.
DeSantis took over from outgoing Governor Rick Scott, who was busy in his last few days in office, making 84 appointments to various government bodies, including the controversial appointment of developer Carlos Baruff, who does not have a stellar environmental record, to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission. The slew of appointments raised questions about whether Scott was trying to impose his legacy far into the DeSantis administration. DeSantis told reporters that he will definitely rescind some of the lame duck appointments and that he's going to look at all of them. DeSantis did seem to signal a turn of direction from the Scott administration when it comes to the environment. He issued an executive order to address Florida's longstanding environmental problems, including $2.5 billion for Everglades restoration and protection of water resources. That move led the Sierra Club Florida director to say, in his first week in office, Governor DeSantis has done more to address Florida's water quality crisis than Governor Rick Scott did in 8 years.
And Akash, I want to ask eventually about the environment, but first of all, you were up there in Tallahassee.
I was.
What was your sense of the direction that Governor DeSantis is going to take the state?
Sum it up, refreshing. It was a new day. The weather was perfect. Everyone was happy with the timeline of the, you know, what didn't carry on. The ceremony was great. And it was a bunch of young folks that I saw energized.
Now, is there tension between the outgoing governor, Rick Scott, and the incoming governor, Ron DeSantis? Because Scott made all these appointments, and DeSantis said he's going to look at a lot of them, maybe rescind some of them.
Well, I think a lot of them were reappointments, and then there were some new ones. But as a governor, that's his right. And I think DeSantis has a few people he's picked out for some of these positions, so I think he's going to rescind all of them, I think, and then review who was reappointed. But I mean, I've been appointed twice by Governor Scott. It's a long process, so I think the timing was right along their due diligence. They have to review every candidate that applies.
The governor made some moves on the environment this week, and the Sierra Club said that in the first week, DeSantis has accomplished more on the environment than the outgoing governor did in 8 years.
One positive thing during the campaign that DeSantis did do was try to stake out a claim on the environment to try to peel off those independent and whatever couple of Democrat voters were out there to make a difference. I think the one thing, the overriding thing to me that was the most interesting part was that he never once mentioned Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump has been the vortex of politics, whether on a local, state, and national level, and he owes his entire governorship to Donald Trump. And not once did he mention that. He would have never gotten out. We Adam Putnam busted his tail for decades to become the next governor of Florida. And because of Donald Trump's blessing, this guy becomes, you know, the nominee in the Republican Party and then now the governor. So as far as the environment is concerned, yes, I think we'll see what happens. I mean, Big Sugar, I can tell you, being in Tallahassee, they have their tentacles. They give to both sides. I mean, they have their tentacles all up and down, and every legislator
gets
to check.
This week it was reported that Big Sugar has made major contributions to the Republican Party of Florida.
Right. Yeah. So he may be the governor, but he also has to deal with the legislature. And the Republican Party is in the pocket of Big Sugar. So we'll see what happens in the end.
Molly, one of the terms that didn't come up as the governor was barnstorming the state, touting these new environmental positions, climate change. He never mentioned it once, although I think, you know, to his credit, he wants to move ahead with Everglades restoration. He wants to attack the problems of red tide. He wants to appoint a science advisor to be permanent in the government. All moves lauded by environmentalists.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting the little dance he's doing. There could be a kind of a political calculation here that he doesn't want to inflame his own party right off the bat. He doesn't want to inflame the friendly legislature by going out and pounding the table about climate change. But at the same time, you know, he called this a unifying issue, and I think that's true. Every Floridian cares about this red tide stuff, cares about the toxic algae, and he's talking about real money, not just you know, sustainability in an abstract sense.
There was some talk this week about tension between the outgoing governor Rick Scott and DeSantis. Scott left a little early from the inauguration in Tallahassee and had to fly back to Washington, D.C. for his own installation. But these appointments, too, you know, it's been said in some quarters that both DeSantis and Scott eventually want to run for U.S. president, and that's the cause of some of this tension.
I think we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit there. I think the Republican Party is largely unified, but there have been cracks for years. I mean, Rick Scott basically split the party in half when he said, I'm taking all of my fundraising and all of my let's get to work money away from the Republican Party. So I think we're seeing the remnants of really 4+ years of Governor Scott's political friction. And Scott was an outsider, right? So you have DeSantis coming in, who has a lot more political experience. And I think his decisions on the environment, his very first few days, show not just he understands Florida's environment a little better than Rick Scott did, certainly Scott's first term, but it also shows he understands politics better. He understands the need to come in with something populist and popular and really get off on the right foot. Rick Scott did the opposite. Rick Scott was aloof to the needs of Floridians his first few years, and he was frankly aloof to a lot of the legislature too. So I expect a lot more of what Rick Scott did with the new governor, but also a little more smooth handling with the legislature and some political decisions.
Right. And let's be honest, Florida's a purple state. I mean, you know, there's almost a million more Democrats than Republicans. So you got to think, just how does a Republican get elected? It's because you got to stake out positions on things like the environment. But to say I'm for the Everglades and then say you don't believe in climate change is bizarre to me, because that's an overriding issue to me personally. And when I worked for Governor Graham, he did leave a little history here. We did have a governor between Governor Graham and the next governor named Wayne Mixon, who was governor for about a few days. Yes. So Governor Graham went to Washington to get sworn in as our senator, and Wayne Mixon became governor. But I don't know what goes on in Scott's head. I he's won by the skin of his teeth 3 elections now, and he does it by doing just enough to win, and it's just staking out some of these positions.
Molly, did you want to?
I think visiting the Panhandle hurricane-ravaged parts of the panhandle is an example of what Noah was talking about, that he has a read of, you know, what do people want to see from him right out of the gate.
And towards the end of the week, Governor DeSantis has been saying about President Trump and this possibility that Trump would use his emergency powers to divert funds from hurricane relief. DeSantis said, no, you can't do that.
Pushed back.
Yeah. He has a lawyer. He said, I don't know if that's legal.
And I'm glad you brought that up. That's a very good point, because here, this is where Donald Trump fits in, because, you know, because of the hurricane that hit Florida, that whole part of the panhandle was devastated to this day.
Right.
And to just not have a comment on the fact that Donald Trump's going to pull billions of dollars away for that stupid wall in Mexico, and Floridians are going to have to suffer about that, to not have any comment to God forbid, he offends Donald Trump. I mean, he's got to think of Floridians first. He should have a comment to say, no, we need that money. It's more important here than to go into the border.
Let's keep the focus on the incoming governor. Governor DeSantis kept one of his main campaign promises on Wednesday by beginning a shift to the political right on the Florida Supreme Court. DeSantis appointed Barbara Lagoa to the state's high court. She's the first ever Cuban-American woman to hold a post on the court. Lagoa is currently a judge on the 3rd District Court of Appeals, which hears cases from Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. DeSantis has a total of 3 Supreme Court justices to appoint right away, as the court's most prominent liberals and moderates are stepping down because they've reached the mandatory retirement age. In the coming days, he'll fill the other 2 vacancies on the 7-member court. During the campaign, DeSantis said that he hoped to alter the judiciary here in Florida for a generation, and he promised to appoint state Supreme Court justices in the mold of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. All right, so Vic, we've been talking about the bipartisan nature of the governor. Now, here's where he shows his Republican colors. Is somebody like Clarence Thomas, is that what Floridians want on the state Supreme Court?
No. And actually, as a Cuban-American, I am proud of the fact that she is a Cuban-American appointee to the court. But, you know, the proof's in the pudding. I mean, let's, you know, just like the Everglades and environment, everything else we're talking about, you know, there's a lot has to be said about what they actually are going to perform. Frankly, he's done some horrible appointments. Corcoran, for example, to run education is going to be a disaster, because when he was speaker, for example, one year he gave $400 million to private charter schools and zero to public schools. I mean, that's a very bad appointment. Danny Young here, he's a local person too. Danny Young was just appointed to head one of the biggest industries in the state of Florida, which is tourism. She has no experience in tourism. I don't even know if she's been a housekeeper in a hotel. I just don't understand. That makes no sense. That's a very critical, important industry in the state. And those are, you know, yes, this appointment to the judgeship may be interesting, but I think there's a lot of other appointees that he's doing that I think are going to be bad, personally.
I disagree, Vic. I think that what you're seeing is Governor DeSantis relying a lot on his team. And Lieutenant Governor Nunez is part of his team, and she's very active, a former legislator. And you're seeing a lot of legislators get appointed. You see Representative Burgess in Pasco County is now Veterans Affairs Secretary. Senator Young is Visit Florida. I think Representative Beshear is as DPBR and other appointments. And I think that's what you're seeing is he knows that he's got to pass a budget through the legislature. You've got to work with your team. And as far as the appointment to the judiciary goes, that was his campaign promise. He wanted to find justices that are going to know the role of the judiciary. And he found one in the Justice Lagoa.
Noah and Molly, we're headed towards a super conservative majority on the Florida Supreme Court. What is that?
20 years of Republican governors will do that. And, you know, to the credit of Charlie Crist, Jeb Bush, they had a much more moderate approach toward it.
Yes.
But Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis made it very clear they wanted conservative judges on there. The newest appointment is a member of the Federalist Society. The other appointments we expect from Governor DeSantis will be as well. Those are judges who are very hands-off with the judiciary. And if you've listened to any outspoken Republican in recent years, they call it the judiciary that legislates where they shouldn't be legislating, legislating from the bench. You're not going to see that from the new Florida Supreme Court.
Molly, that is the defense that the governor makes. And even Justice Lagoa made that statement as she was being introduced. She said, I'm not one who legislates from the bench.
Yeah, I mean, that's a trendy trendy phrase right now.
If you're Republican, yes.
You know, Republicans in Tallahassee don't like it because the Florida Supreme Court has invalidated a lot of the laws that they've passed. And I'm thinking of abortion laws, welfare testing for drug recipients. You know, applying the constitutional test to these laws, I don't think it's legislating from the bench, but that's what they call it. And the other disappointing thing about this process is that the Judicial Nominating Commission that interviewed all the candidates for these three seats and chose the finalists had a number of African-American judges on the list, very qualified ones, including a judge from this circuit, and there isn't a single African American on the list of finalists, and the governor has to choose from that list. And it's really not so much about, you know, meeting a racial quota as having a high court that looks like Florida.
Yeah. So the first time in decades, no African American on the upcoming
Supreme
Court.
When you want to cut from the cloth of Clarence Thomas, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, the seven candidates for Tampa mayor held their first televised debate this week. The field, which includes former police chief Jane Castor, former Hillsborough County Commissioner Ed Taranchik, businessman David Straz, and two city council members, Harry Cohen and Mike Suarez, got into a heated discussion about policing and the high number of tickets given to African-American bicyclists while Castor was police chief.
We installed over 2,000 bike lights and wrote warnings before any citation was ever issued. But the tickets were a mistake because they caused tension in the very neighborhoods that we were trying to protect.
If you were riding a bike and you happened to be stopped, you had to show that you owned the bike. Now, I know that if you want to make sure your bike is safe and it's stolen, you can identify it. They should have gone out into the community and asked people to bring their bikes to them as opposed to stopping them and ask for a receipt. They would make sure that you had a receipt and then you had to show it.
No one had to. This is just, you know, you're
so
just.
So the reporting is incorrect, is what you're saying.
Where was that ever reported?
Oh, it was reported widely. I don't know if you read the Times.
No, nobody ever had to have a receipt for their bicycle.
Go to East Tampa and talk to residents.
Yeah. People have been talking about
it. All right, we have to move on.
Well, the police issue was one of the highlights of that debate, but I want to say, as we sat down to record this show, Dick Greco Jr., a retired judge in Hillsborough County, announced that he is running. So now there are eight candidates in the race.
Nine
candidates.
Depending on your count. They have a week to qualify and officially get in. But Dick Greco Jr. makes this wide open race even more so. And the general election, which is held in March, it's really a race to get in the top two. Everyone assumes Jane Castor will be one of the two, so it's a race to run against Jane. Mm-hmm. And it's wide open. You've got all these basically men who kind of look the same who are running from their little pockets of support across Tampa. The turnout will be low. It's not going to take a lot to get into the runoff, and it'll be very interesting what happens. I'm not sure a lot of people are watching these little forums and debates.
All right, and there's a bunch of them. Molly, how do you think the dynamics change when you add Dick Greco Jr. to the race?
Well, I mean, he obviously has name recognition, and a lot of these other guys don't, and so, you know, he has an advantage right away with that. Mm-hmm.
And do you think that Jane Castor is going to be held back by the Times series? I mean,
I do. Yeah. I think everybody will bring it up every single chance they get. Yeah. I mean, it's 3 years ago now, but it was a very damning reflection on her department.
You know, one thing that isn't brought up very much, and I wish it would be, 3 years ago, right around the same time that the Times did their great Biking While Black series, at Channel 10, we did a series, it was almost a week apart, showing how the number of people who are getting pulled over in Tampa were skewing overwhelmingly black as well. Same issue, they're targeting certain communities where, yes, crime is higher, but nobody's talking about how should we change this. Nobody's talking about, you know, why do we have so many minorities arrested in Tampa compared to our surrounding communities? Way more than St. Petersburg, way more than Polk County or anywhere up and down the coast.
So Castor's vulnerable on that issue. Akash, handicap the race for us right now?
I think Suarez did a great job at the debate, and so did Cohen. A lot of people, you know, one of the questions was if you weren't the front runner, who else would you vote for? And the only person that answered the question was Chief Castor. Right. She said, I would vote for Cohen because he knows budgeting. And I think that was a surprise, but I think it's still early. You're going to have a lot of forums this week. And I think, you know, this police issue is going to continue to come up. I do respect Chief Castor for admitting and saying, taking full responsibility. But the aftermath was that the Citizens Review Commission was started, and there's a lot of trickling effects that are still in place today. It'll be interesting to see how they keep bringing it up against her.
Vic, is it too late for newcomers to get in the race like Dick Recko Jr.?
I personally think so. I mean, I've been involved in the last four mayor's races in Tampa, and I can tell you from personal, and I lived here my whole life. I live in Tampa, and I can tell you, Noah's right. It's a very low turnout race. Out of the 100% of people can vote, you might get 15, 18, 20%. So and all these debates that you're talking about, they're going on every single day. The people are going to vote are going to size up every single candidate. And I think Castor has a shot in because she's the only woman in the race. And all my friend, every day I get hit up by somebody and say, who's going to win? And I said, if you hold a gun to my head, you might as well pull the trigger because I cannot predict who's going to be in the runoff. It's going to be very tight. Stratus has a lot of money. Suarez is West Tampa. Harry's very well known in South Tampa. And there's unknowns like Taranchik. And
Greco coming. The environmental community behind him.
Right, yeah. And you got Topher Morrison out there, who the progressives, like what happened with Gillum in the governor's race, the progressives are kind of lining up behind Topher. So if you have all these top five, six, seven, eight guys beating each other up, Topher could sneak in. As crazy as that sounds, that in a very super low turnout race, you know, it's really wide open. We are fortunate. A lot of these guys are very qualified. I think Tampa's very lucky to have this many people qualified running for mayor.
All right, well, last Tuesday, Amendment 4 went into effect across the state. That's the amendment passed by Florida voters allowing most felons who have completed their sentences to register to vote. Local election supervisors saw a spike over the usual number of voter registrations for this time of year. The amendment affects about 1.4 million ex-felons here in Florida. All right. So, Molly, how much of a difference do you think this is going to make in statewide elections and local elections?
I think it's a little too early to tell, but Tuesday was a really big day, and people voted with their feet. You know, they showed up, they registered, and it's to the credit of the election supervisors that everything went so smoothly. There was some noise in Tallahassee after the amendment passed that, you know, it couldn't go into effect until they passed some implementing language. But the supervisors were clear. Brian Corley in Pasco County said, however you felt about this amendment, the language was crystal clear that people could go register, and they did. And, you know, it could have a little bit of effect on the Tampa mayor's race, I suppose. This is a population that doesn't historically turn out in huge numbers. But then again, this was a really big deal for these people.
Is all that talk about Tallahassee getting involved, is that done, or is it going to come up? Are they still talking about getting involved and tweaking the amendment when the legislature meets?
I can't imagine the legislature passing up on the chance to meddle in this issue. you know, there might also be some helpful laws passed that could, yeah. For instance, Daryl Roussan in St. Petersburg has talked about creating a hotline to help former felons check on the status of their own sentencing to make sure they're really completed everything.
No, I guess the big question is a lot of people did sign up on Tuesday when the amendment took effect. The next day, amendment levels went back down to their usual. So there was a lot of excitement on that first day. The question is, how long lasting? Will this 1.4 million potential new voters?
We saw the most excited people come out on day one. It was thousands across the state. We know they'll tend to lean Democrat, but even thousands of votes aren't enough to swing any of the close elections we just had. And much like the Puerto Rican vote, they made such a big deal about that after the Hurricane Maria. We're going to have so many Puerto Ricans. Whoever wins the Puerto Rican vote is going to win the next race. It turned out to probably not be a thing at all. You know, when you look at big masses of people coming into the voting registry, it doesn't mean they're actually going to vote, and we haven't seen that yet.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Victor, let's start with you.
I think the demise of the stadium in Hillsborough County was, as they say in history, it's over-exaggerated. Having worked in sports broadcasting in the past, I can tell you one thing MLB and the Rays are not going to give up is that $1.4 billion TV contract that the Rays are going to get in this market. So if you hear all the other scuttlebutt of Las Vegas and Charlotte, those are much smaller markets. And we think of the Rays here in the Tampa Bay area as being TV, but I've been to Tallahassee and Jacksonville, Orlando, and the entire north part of the state is all Rays territory when it comes to cable. And that's a very big nut that nobody's going to give up easily. So it's and they really cut their throats by saying we're going to go back to St. Pete. It's going to be a lot more negotiation going on. The Rays are not leaving Tampa Bay.
All right. Akash, your other big story.
Yeah, I think you saw some fingers pointing and some attacks happen at the last mayor's debate we just talked about. You got three more this week and then a few the following week. I think you're going to start seeing endorsements. A lot of people are reporting money since, you know, it's going to be crunch time for their PACs. I think you'll see some big names get involved in the races that have been on the sidelines.
All right. It's going to get nastier?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Right. Molly, your other big story.
This morning was the first meeting of the new state cabinet with Governor DeSantis and the other constitutional officers, and they made history. They pardoned the Groveland Four, and this is a horrific case in Florida history, four black men accused of raping a white woman and then put through the Jim Crow ringer and deprived of justice, and they finally got it this morning.
All right, finally justice. Noah, your other big story?
Anyone who drives a Florida toll road has probably heard me talk about SunPass and the disaster this has been. The negligence inside Florida's Department of Transportation this last 7 months puts the Broward Sheriff and Broward Supervisor of Elections to shame. But Governor Scott snuck out the back door without really doing anything at all about this. He was politically connected to the contractor responsible. Governor DeSantis is as well, but this is a great chance for Governor DeSantis in his first few days in office to come out, hold his own Department of Transportation accountable, hold this contractor accountable, and name a new head of FDOT from the outside, because there are so many problems on the inside of FDOT that the governor needs to look outside that department for a fix.
No, you're stepping down. You're leaving the Tampa Bay area. We're going to miss you, but who's going to be dogging that story?
I hope the Times or someone at another TV station picks it up. The SunPass saga is far from over. Me, personally, I'm moving on to opportunities up north in New York. But it's been 10 great years here, and I won't be a stranger.
You have made so many changes in this place. We're going to miss you.
I hope I've left it a better place.
All right. Well, thank you all for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week. Your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftw@wedu.org. That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. It's a panel discussion about state and local politics. And my guests on that panel, Noah Pransky, who's leaving WTSP, unfortunately. He was one of the journalists on the panel. And Akash Patel, he is a Republican. He was on the panel. Victor Mayo, a Democrat, was on the panel. And Molly Moorhead, who's an editorial writer at the Tampa Bay Times. She was the other journalist on that panel. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the last few minutes, you can email your comment into our studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa. We talked a little bit on that program about the Tampa mayor's race. And as you know, here on WMNF, we've been interviewing the candidates for Tampa mayor. Two more candidate interviews this week are scheduled. Mike Suarez will be interviewed tomorrow here at 11 a.m. And Jane Castor will be interviewed Wednesday on this show at 11 a.m. So if you're interested in the Tampa mayor's race, two of the top contenders for mayor will be in the studios live this week. Well, this is WMNF in Tampa. No doubt the biggest story of the past 3 or 4 days are those New York Times and Washington Post reports about Russia and the president. Let me just read a little bit from the Associated Press this morning. The AP is reporting that some White House officials are expressing regret that President Trump didn't more clearly and forcefully deny working on behalf of Russia when asked about it during a Fox News interview with Jeanine Pirro, who is a personal friend of President Trump's. That's according to aides and Republicans close to the White House who spoke to the Associated Press. The New York Times reported that law enforcement officials began investigating in 2017 whether Trump had been working on behalf of Russia against U.S. interests. When asked about the Times report on Fox, Trump called it insulting. In the same interview, Trump also objected to a report in the Washington Post that said that he went to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, even from high-ranking officials in his own organization. Trump never answered Pirro directly, but he went on to assert that no president has taken a harder stance against Russia than he has. He said that if you ask the folks in Russia, I've been tougher on Russia than anybody else, probably any other president, period, but certainly the last 3 or 4 presidents. Trump's claim, though, was disputed by Virginia Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Warner said almost all the sanctions on Russia arose not in the White House, but in Congress, due to concerns by members of both parties about Moscow's actions. Warner accused the White House of being very slow to put in place the penalties against Moscow. The New York Times reported that FBI agents and some top officials became suspicious of Trump's ties to Russia during the 2016 presidential campaign, but they did not open an inquiry at that time because they weren't sure how to approach such a sensitive probe. Trump's behavior in the days around James Comey's firing from the FBI in May of 2017 helped trigger the counterintelligence part of the probe, according to the New York Times. In the inquiry, counterintelligence investigators sought to evaluate whether Trump was a potential threat to national security. They also sought to determine whether Trump was deliberately working for Russia or had unintentionally been influenced by Russia. Well, that is the big story, that along with the Washington Post story saying that the president has collected the notes from his translators as from the meetings that he had with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. All this came up on one of the shows that we carry on our HD3 channel, The Source, which is our all-news and talk channel. We have a great program in the afternoon called Background Briefing. It's on every afternoon at 4 o'clock. And Ian McMaster, who's a reporter at KPFK in Los Angeles, interviewed Seth Hetna, who's an award-winning journalist who has been an investigative reporter for the Associated Press for a long time. He wrote a book called Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. And Ian asked Hetna about these latest stories about President Trump. And here's part of that interview. We're going to listen back to it now.
Obstructing his own administration from insight into his dealings with Putin kind of tells you a lot. It's an indication that he, you know, what I've suspected all along, that the president has something to hide when it comes to his relationship with the Kremlin. And there's no other reason for him to be so reticent about letting his own administration understand what he's talking about with Putin.
Well, on the other side, of course, the other explosive story, the New York Times story, that counterintelligence investigators were after Comey was fired, they were basically asked to look into whether or not the president's own actions can constitute a possible threat to national security, and they were tasked to determine whether Mr. Trump was knowingly working for Russia or had unwittingly fallen under Moscow's influence. What I find extraordinary, none of this is surprising, and I'm sure it's absolutely no surprise to you, Seth, but it's again. These stories tie other stuff that's been out there and give it a new context. For example, the story in the New York Times that we're just talking about puts into context, at least in my mind, why it is that Trump has been absolutely railing against a number of FBI figures, McCabe, Peter Strzok, and Bruce Orr. All of them have been singled out publicly by Trump, who's absolutely attacked them, and then the Fox News echo chamber has vilified these guys. It turns out that every one of those, starting with Andrew McCabe, who after Comey was fired became the acting director of the FBI, it was McCabe who tasked those other people I just mentioned to form this counterintelligence team to look into whether Trump, what is going on between Trump and Russia? So that's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it? He goes after those same people?
Absolutely. Well, just to take you made a couple of points there that I think are worth expanding on a little bit. You know, first, it's not a surprise that Trump is viewed some people view Trump as an agent of Russia or a possible agent of Russia. You know, that's been said for a long time, even by former government officials. I don't know if you recall, but Michael Morell, who was a former acting director of the CIA, wrote an op-ed during the campaign saying he was going to vote for Clinton because he thought Trump was an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. So this has been said a long time. What's different is the government acting on this supposition, taking, you know, opening a counterintelligence investigation into the President of the United States. It's one thing for you or I to talk about this or people to write op-eds. It's a totally different thing when the government takes an action. And I think people need to understand that. It brings it to a new level. what's interesting to me is that this story came out now. Now that we have a Democratic House, and today, I don't know if you saw, but Jerry Nadler, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he's going to investigate this and probably bring the FBI agents to testify, probably in closed-door session. But it seems to me like the FBI agents may have come up with something here, and they want this information passed to Congress. And that was, I think, one of the reasons that we saw the story come out when it did. This, after all, happened in 2017 is when the investigation opened, and we're only hearing about it a year and a half later. And to take your second point that, yeah, Trump has been, and he's made no secret of this. And he was asked by Jeanine Pirro yesterday, flat out, are you an unwitting agent? Notably, he didn't deny that he was. He said it was the most insulting thing he's ever been asked. And then he proceeds to go and rail on Comey and Peter Strzok and Lisa Page and all the and Andrew McKay and all these people who have opened this investigation. So, yeah, he is going after the people who are investigating him. That that's exactly what he's doing, and the only reason he's doing it is to stop, you know, the FBI from learning what it's learned. It's again, you know, just as it is with this Washington Post story about the hiding the his conversation with Putin, and the New York Times story show is in my mind evidence of guilt. That you have a person behaving suspiciously, trying to hide, stop, quash an investigation, and trying to prevent his own administration from learning his discussions with the leader of a hostile foreign power. You know, so that's the back-to-back message that was delivered this weekend.
And again, I'm speaking with Seth Hatton, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. And his latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. Of course, the threshold for a counterintelligence investigation is not the same as a criminal investigation where there's a crime and they're looking for who did it or who done it, I guess. In this case, it follows a different path, does it not? Where you basically are trying to gather evidence, which may or may not be ever used in court, and basically doesn't determine guilt. Which I guess
correct. You're trying to determine whether a threat exists, and then neutralize that threat. So it can go into court. For example, when the FBI rounded up 10 non-official cover agents of Russia who were posing as ordinary citizens, and that did wind up in court. But it does, those things, even if they do wind up in court, they don't often go to trial because they reveal sources and methods. So usually they stay out of the court system. So we don't know where this investigation went or what it found. It dovetailed in with Robert Mueller's own investigation. So I think whatever was known to those agents is obviously known by Robert Mueller and presumably will be part or inform his final report. But, you know, as far as prosecuting someone for being an agent, you know, Trump, let me just back up a bit. The funny thing about being an agent is, in Trump's case, he can be an agent of a foreign power and still believe that he's not. And that's what's called an unwitting agent. That Trump is so susceptible to flattery and ego stroking and manipulation.
And money.
It wouldn't take much to get him to take positions as he has favorable to Russia and antithetical to the United States. You know, in fact, if you gave him a list, if Vladimir Putin had given him a list of things that he wanted, Trump to take stances he would take out that were beneficial to Russia, Trump has kind of gone down there just ticking them off one by one. So he's been very beneficial to Russia, and he may still believe that he's not an agent and yet may be one, and that's what we don't know because he's hiding his own conversations with Putin, who, you know, I don't need to remind you, is a master manipulator who's trained in KGB tactics of manipulation.
Well, Seth Hatton, we know that on December the 10th of 2016, after Trump's election before his inauguration, that Jared Kushner met with Soviet or Russian ambassador Kislyak and the head of the VNB bank, which is largely referred to as Putin's slush fund, at which Jared Kushner asked for the establishment of a secret back channel between Trump and the Kremlin. And then, of course, he then turned around and Kushner asked for $500 million to bail out a bad real estate investment at 666 Fifth Avenue. But the fact that that happened is just extraordinary. But then if you fast forward to what's happening just in the last week, where Trump made this extraordinary rambling press conference at which he gave the Russian line on rewriting the history of their intervention in Afghanistan. So that, you know, inquiring minds want to know, you know, what's going on here? You know, you wanted to set up a back channel, and now you're parroting the Kremlin's talking points. Does a back channel exist, do you think?
Well, it certainly seems that way. You know, I don't know who the back channel is. It may be Putin, it may be somebody else. But Trump is vulnerable to this kind of exploitation. He uses a cell phone that is insecure. He takes calls directly from world leaders, according to the reporting. So he's totally ripe for exploitation. And I'd be surprised. In fact, I'd be surprised if there wasn't a back channel. We don't know who it is. Trump is repeatedly coming out with these bizarre talking points, as he has throughout his presidency. So someone, and he's not a student of history. He doesn't read books. So someone is telling him these things. We just don't know who.
Well, have you heard reports and rumors that that Mueller is concerned that there is a Russian mole in the FBI's office in New York?
I have not seen that. No. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is, you know, obviously this report that Mueller is doing. Is as these news stories which we're talking about come out, this puts makes more people more curious and impatient to get the real story from a professional prosecutor. Then, of course, we look at the chaos at the DOJ. Whitaker, the acting AG, who's got his head down now. We know he's been put in there to somehow stymie the Mueller report. And then we've got Barr, the new Attorney General, designates his testimony next week. He also, like Whitaker, appeared to audition for the job, castigating Mueller to get Trump's attention and therefore get the job. Are you concerned that the very thing that we need to tie all these things together to verify much of what's in your book and other books and to support this recent reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that's on the line? Do you think we'll get the final reckoning here?
I do. I think we tend to focus on, you know, individuals rather than systems. And, you know, Mueller can be replaced or fired, but you can't fire the FBI. You can't fire the CIA. And there are people in the government who have this information at many different levels. And, you know, I think that this information is going to be passed to Congress before too long. So I think there may be, you know, there may be a dramatic firing here and there. You can't, but really this is one of the great saving graces of America, is that we have a system of laws that is greater than any individual. And that, I think that will save the Republic in the end if we do have an agent of a foreign power in the White House.
So, and I guess just to finish up on it, Seth, that Trump seems to only have Jeanine Pirro at Fox to go to now to put out his version of the story, whereas public testimony from Michael Cohen, which I think is going to get huge ratings, along with public testimony from the House Intelligence Committee, are likely to also get more ratings. And, of course, Jeanine Pirro is somewhat conflicted because her husband is a fraudster who was busted by the FBI, and she has a jihad against the FBI. So these people aren't particularly credible on the Trump side, but I suspect that the testimony coming from Michael Cohen and from the House Intelligence Committee is, you know, it's going to be pretty galvanizing, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. There's the problem with credibility is that Trump has none. He's lied so many times, and in fact, he doesn't open his mouth seemingly without lying. That you know that his credibility has been reduced to next to nothing or lower than nothing, if that's possible. But and so someone like Michael Cohen, who also has lied, you know, has more credibility than Trump is a pretty astonishing fact. And yeah, I think this is just the beginning. I think Cohen is going to start the ball rolling, and I think we're going to see, you know, there's a reason why we're seeing all these stories now popping up, and the reason why we're talking is because there are forces working behind the scenes trying to get this information out there and trying to get Congress to take some action, and I think that's what we're going to see in the next year, the final year or two of Trump's first term.
Well, Seth Hettner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Hettner, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. His latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Israel's covert war.
Well, that was Ian McMaster, who hosts a show on WMNF's HD3 channel, The Source, every afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's called Background Briefing. As you heard, Ian is one of the smartest people on radio, and it's a great program every afternoon on HD3 at 4 o'clock. And so what do you think about that? Some of the points that they talked about, Trump may be an unwitting agent. We don't know, but he may be, according to what Ian said. That the president is susceptible to flattery. They reminded us that Putin is a master manipulator trained by the KGB, and that Jared Kushner met with top Russian officials, including a top Russian banker who was very close to Putin, and asked for a bailout of $500 million for some of the Trump businesses. So we could talk about that. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Of course, we're talking overall about the New York Times report that said that the FBI had begun investigating the possibility that Trump was a covertly tied to the Russian government. I'll just read the New York Times report Friday cited unnamed former law enforcement officials and others familiar with the investigation, suggesting that President Trump might have been working on behalf of Russia. And this was an investigation that was started in May of 2017, reported by the New York Times. And then the Washington Post over the weekend reported that President Trump went to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, even from high-ranking officials in his own administration. So if you want to comment about this, call us up, 813-239-9663. Frank Knox is our phone producer today. Tony writes this. He says, this is a question that America must face. Dare we use the old-fashioned word treason with regard to our president? The American public should demand that our elected representatives get to the bottom of this as soon as possible. Why should one elected by a minority of voters be making policies such as the shutdown if he follows Russia's bidding? I call Senators Rubio and Scott. I hope others do too. So there's Tony in St. Pete who's already called his U.S. senators. Let's go to the phones. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Rich in Clearwater. Hi, Rich. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Good morning. I have a question. Has anybody investigated Melania Trump's background? Is there any potential foreign influence coming from that direction?
Yeah, I don't think there's been any official investigation, no investigation that's been publicly revealed. I kind of doubt whether there has. There have been questions raised about how she immigrated to this country. There have been some good news reports about that, but whether or not she's an influencer working for a foreign government, I have no idea.
Well, great. I appreciate you even considering that, and I'm happy listening to this discussion. So,
all right, Rich, thanks a lot. Thank you. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Let's go to Rod in Largo. Rod, you're on. What would you like to say?
Well, what I'd like to say is I've thought this from day one. I've figured he was a Manchurian candidate. I mean, his whole financial dealings when he was down the tubes back in the 80s, and they figured he was going to be selling used cars for a living, and then couple years later, he comes out with all this money and influence and power. It was amazing to me. I figured the Russians had been grooming him for a while, and that most of his money that he does have comes from Russia and oligarchs. And I think the thing, like I said, I think he's been a Manchurian candidate for a long time.
All right. Well, we'll see where these investigations go. Rod, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, that's all what I think everybody wants to know. Are these allegations true or false? And let's hope that Congress will investigate them thoroughly. On CNN this morning, John Avlon talked about the claims by President Trump that he's been tougher on Russia than any other president. Let's listen into a little bit of this. You can watch this on the CNN website, by the way. Here's John Avlon.
The FBI suspected the president of the United States of being a Russian asset, and that he took his interpreter's notes away in order to hide details about a private meeting with Putin. Now, this isn't film noir fan fiction. This is 2019. And as part of Trump's counterattack, he trotted out one of his favorite talking points. Quote, I have been far tougher on Russia than Obama, Bush, or Clinton. Maybe tougher than any other president. This is quickly echoed by Sarah Sanders, and it's a claim he's made at least 14 times during his presidency. And like many of his Russia-related claims, it's just not true. There were 101 contacts between Russia-linked operatives in the Trump campaign and transition, according to the Moscow Project, which is funded by Liberal Policy Group. That includes 28 meetings, and there was an attempt to, quote, cover up every single one of them. During the 2016 convention, Trump aides watered down platform language regarding Russia and Ukraine, and candidate Trump called on Russians to hack his opponent's emails, which they tried to do the very same day. During the transition, Michael Flynn and Eric Prince back-channeled with Russians, presumably about sanctions imposed by the Obama administration. And of course, the only human being on Earth President Trump refuses to criticize is Vladimir Putin. He's even admitted Russia's influence on his decisions, telling their ambassador in a private Oval Office meeting, quote, I faced great pressure because of Russia, and by firing Comey, that pressure was taken off. That's according to the Times. This is the opposite of tough talk, but what about his actions? Well, it's fair to say that Trump's OG national security team of Mattis, McMaster, and Tillerson were far tougher on Russia, calling out the country in national security strategy and pushing for lethal arms sales to Ukraine. But Trump reportedly told aides not to talk up the Ukrainian arms deal, and all three of those Russia hawks got the boot. Now, Team Trump often points to Russia's sanctions as evidence of their toughness. But the new sanctions were only enacted after the Senate voted 98-2, everyone except Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul, to force the administration into action. Trump reluctantly signed the bill after pronouncing the sanctions, quote, seriously flawed. And then his administration slow-rolled their implementation. Well, now Democrats are grilling Trump's Treasury Secretary over a puzzling recent decision to let a key Russian oligarch's companies off the hook. Trump has consistently acted outside American norms, but consistent with Russian goals, from attacking the EU and NATO, accepting Putin's seizure of Crimea, and abruptly announcing the U.S. withdrawal from Syria, functionally ceding the region to Russia and its allies. And after the Trump administration announced it was expelling 60 Russian diplomats in retaliation for the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter from British soil, Trump was reportedly furious that we went too far.
Well, that was a part of what John Avlon is reporting on CNN. You can see the entire report on the CNN.com website investigating President Trump's claims that he's tougher on Russia than any president. Let's go back to the phones. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gino in Tampa. Hi, Gino. You're on. What would you like to say?
My comment is about the report about the Groveland four. It's just a shame that they, you know, that America keeps doing this, especially in Florida. From my understanding right now, that's the third city in Florida that that happened to. The most notable, of course, is Rosewood. They wiped out the whole town there, but it's happening. And I think it happened in, I just learned about one, I think, in Oviedo, a little bit closer to Orlando, with the same thing happening, where these mobs go in and shoot off the town and kill up the people, and then they get arrested. They kill the people in jail. I mean, this is just a shame that it keeps doing it. So I know it means more to the family to have their family vindicated, but it keeps happening and keeps, well, it used to keep happening and keep happening, and it's just a shame that these things happen like that.
Well, I think it's fair to say that at the time it happened, and then everybody was probably, well, I don't know what everybody thought, but there was a cover-up. And so for like 30, in the case of Groveland, you know, it was long forgotten until reporters began to write books about it in the last few years.
Yeah, the sheriff was, he was a part of it. It was the
sheriff McCall.
That killed, he killed the guy and they was trying to escape.
yeah, that was terrible. And Gino, I hope you heard Democracy Now! Today because it was great. And most of it was about Groveland.
Oh, so, really? No, yeah.
You can go back in the archives. Gino, thanks a lot. You can go back in the archives and listen to it. And also, you can listen to it on our HD3 channel, The Source, because we replay Democracy Now! Today at 5 o'clock. But most of Democracy Now! Today was all about Groveland. Thanks to Frank Knox, our phone producer today. Stay tuned. Sean Cannan is coming up next with the Midpoint Program. I'm Rob Lori. This is WMNF Tampa.